All right, I've started my stopwatch. I'd just like to thank Carissa Gold, Roger Waltz, Mary over here, and all the other people whose names I don't know who helped put this on, and Larry as well. Great, thank you. I'm going to talk about clotting and bleeding. Now, they happen to be the major causes of mortality. And I don't know if you can read the lines here, but this is heart disease, number of deaths, heart disease and stroke directly caused by clotting and bleeding are the major causes of death in this world. And these happen to be two fields in which my research has contributed a bit over the years, so I'm going to concentrate on those two aspects of life. Now, I don't have a picture of Ozzy Osbourne, but I do have Rasputin, not a bad substitute. So let me first talk about the bleeding side. Hemophilia is a common bleeding disorder that people knew about for thousands of years. Queen Victoria happened to be a hemophilia carrier, and she spread hemophilia throughout the royal families of Europe. There are at least 9 known dukes and princes who died of hemophilia who were her descendants, and one of the most famous was the Tsarevich Alexei of Russia, whose treatment by Rasputin and the thrall in which Rasputin held the Russian court, especially his mother Alexandra, was one of the things that helped annoy the citizenry of Russia about the Tsar's realm. Well, after I left Colorado and wound up at Genentech in the 1980s, one of the things that we could do rather easily was find targets for our research. What was hard is the fact that cloning and expressing genes was novel at that point. We were really the first people that could do it. But picking the projects was easy. Matter of fact, I like to point out there was not a single MD at Genentech for the first 10 years because it didn't take much to think that we could replace proteins that were already used to treat diseases, but manufacture the proteins in E. coli or in other sources, which would be more plentiful and perhaps safer. So insulin was one of the early projects that was easy. And Bob Swanson, the wonderful visionary founder of Genentech, used to say to us, just go to the library and find your next project. So perhaps because I had read the book Nicholas and Alexandra, I knew about hemophilia. And only a little bit of digging, you know, let me realize that factor 8, the genetic defect in the clotting factor that causes most of hemophilia, was now treated post-Rasputin by very crude blood products that gave everyone who was a hemophiliac at the time hepatitis. We didn't know about HIV, but by the time we finished, it was estimated that every single severe hemophiliac in the United States had HIV. So it was not much of a stretch to think that cloning and expressing the human factor 8 gene could be a useful thing to do. And as Bob Swanson used to literally come into the lab and punch you on the arm and say, clone that sucker. That's how we got to start our projects. So indeed, we cloned that sucker. And scientifically, it turned out to be quite interesting because there were controversies at the time about where factor 8 was actually made. It wasn't known at the time. People estimated the size of the protein anywhere from a few 100,000 to 400,000 Daltons. So it was a real challenge. It was the largest gene that was cloned at the time. And from the structure, though, we learned some things that were also quite interesting scientifically. And one of them that I am going to digress on for a few moments is the fact that it was made up of repeated units. So there were 3 domains that were almost identical that actually looked like another protein, ceruloplasmin. There were 2 other domains that were also repeated and had some other familiar homologs in the databases. So my digression, because it was interesting, and in those early days of cloning and sequencing, these things were turning up. And that's the fact that proteins and genes have domains. Here's another one that I worked on, plasminogen. Plasminogen has a protease domain that actually cleaves and activates a clotting protein that looks a lot like about 100 other proteases in the human genome. It has five of these domains called kringles from the way they're drawn, and what kringles do are bind fibrin and position this protease at the proper substrate. It turns out that if you start looking at the genes that were being cloned and sequenced, over half of them looked familiar. And that is because evolution, very cleverly, decided that you don't have to reinvent a DNA sequence and a protein sequence every time you needed a new protein. And this is work that a lot of people contributed to, but one of my favorites was Laszlo Pathe from Budapest, who I met and was able to collaborate with. And this is one of his papers, and you know, it's a small diagram, don't even look too hard, but these are 10 domains of proteins that are mixed and matched and shared in hundreds of proteins that are shown here. So it was just a wonderful concept that came into its being around that age where domains of genes, usually flanked by introns so that they can actually move about rather easily in the genome and be inserted into other genes, actually make up modular proteins, and that's one of the ways in which evolution can work. So much for that aside, let's get back to a linear fashion. So we did clone that sucker, and after Genentech sold the project to Bayer, it became Cogenate and became a billion-dollar drug. And that leads me to the next point that I think may be a bit apropos of this meeting, and that's some of the difficulties in choosing your targets and deciding if you're a pharmaceutical company or if you're in the biomedical research world, what to work on, what is its ultimate value. We had this wonderful talk at Genentech given by the vice president of marketing one day in the 80s, and he wanted to point out to us that we shouldn't take him seriously, that market projections are definitely not to be taken too seriously, because Genentech had two products at the time, TPA and growth hormone, and the marketing projection was that they would sell $20 million a year of growth hormone and $2 billion a year of TPA, and at that time, both of them sold $200 million a year, so he said we're off by a factor of 10 in both directions. And that's because you don't have crystal balls. So growth hormone was treated by an animal extract of the protein, thought to be a minor market for growth hormone deficient children, but then it turns out that people getting growth hormone were getting Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a neurological disease from prions that went along with the pituitary extract, so the recombinant product totally replaced that market. Conversely, TPA was going to lyse blood clots when you had a heart attack and do it in such a safe manner that every ambulance driver would come in and inject the guy who's turning blue in bed and his wife is screaming with TPA before they even knew whether he had heartburn or indigestion or really had a heart attack. And it turned out that the wonderful hypothesis that it would not cause bleeding problems because TPA is only activated on a fibrin surface, that hypothesis turned out to be wrong. And the bleeding occurrence of TPA was equal to that of a much less expensive product that was already on the market. So it's a tough business, again, because you don't have a crystal ball. So much for the bleeding side. Now I'm going to switch to the too much clotting side of things. This is, by odds, the thing that will kill more people in this room than anything else, and that's a blood clot in an important artery, such as one in your heart or your brain. And the chief characteristics, this would be the normal blood vessel wall here, but you can see in this advanced lesion a cholesterol-filled plaque. And if you look hard enough, you can even see cholesterol crystals. And the proximal cause of the event is then a rupture of this unstable large plaque and a thrombus that occludes the artery. So part of the problem is this flow of cholesterol in and out of artery walls. It's a delicate balance, and we have to work harder at getting rid of that cholesterol now because we deliver much more of it to our bloodstream than we did 10,000, 20,000 years ago. when we evolved to eat a very different diet. And how is cholesterol trafficked in and out of the artery wall and everywhere else where it has to go? Lipoproteins are things that allow insoluble lipids and fats to be transported throughout our body and to be directed to the proper place. So that's what a lipoprotein is. It's basically a ball of cholesterol and phospholipid with some proteins on the outside that solubilize it and tell it where to go. And I think everybody is familiar with what are now called good and bad cholesterol. And good and bad cholesterol are simply two different lipoprotein particles, low-density and high-density lipoprotein. And the way in which they work at a basic level really makes sense in terms of them being good and bad. This is a classic study from over a decade ago now where mean LDL levels and average risk of a heart attack, and you have increased risk if you have more LDL cholesterol. Conversely, HDL is called the good cholesterol because it has the opposite. And why is the risk profile opposite for both of those? Well, again, it's pretty simple and it's pretty correct, which is that the major activity of LDL is to transport cholesterol from the liver to other sites in the body. And one of those sites we care about is our coronary arteries. And HDL has the opposite effect. It's involved in what's called reverse cholesterol transport, moving excess cholesterol out. And that's because cholesterol is made in every cell in the body. It's needed in every cell of the body to make your cell membranes and to make hormones. And the only way to get rid of excess cholesterol is get it to the liver so it can be excreted in bile acid or cholesterol. So reverse cholesterol transport is important. And there are two sides to therefore to this risk of delivering too much cholesterol to your coronary or your cerebral arteries. Statins are a fabulously effective and highly used class of drug that reduce LDL cholesterol. They're really good. They're very safe. They do a good job in reducing LDL cholesterol, and as a matter of fact, they're the largest class of drugs in the world. One of them alone, Lipitor, sold over $7 billion last year. And yet there's so many people that are affected that there are still some that don't meet their target LDL levels. And importantly, roughly the same number of people that get heart disease have not enough of the good cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, as opposed to having too much of the bad LDL cholesterol. And there are no drugs currently that are satisfactory in raising HDL cholesterol. So there's certainly been a lot of interest in the last decade or so in finding drugs that will do that, that will raise HDL cholesterol and remove excess cholesterol from our artery walls. And at a cellular level, this is where it all begins. This is a macrophage cell in all of our artery walls. Unless you're a newborn or a vegetarian marathon runner, you probably have lots of cells in your arteries that look like this. They are chock full of cholesterol, which they're trying to gather up, detoxify, and get rid of. But as so many other things that cause disease, such as inflammatory factors and complement activation, they're meant to do a job, but they can become overwhelmed and turn around and bite you. And that's what happens with cells like this, because eventually they're overwhelmed by cholesterol and they do bad things in the artery wall, including weakening that wall so that the thrombus can occur. So this is where reverse cholesterol transport starts, with cells like that. And here's the cartoon of the pathway. So now, here's one of those cells in your artery wall that you just saw by electron microscopy. And what happens is that by some process that was unknown when we started on this project, the cholesterol gets out, it's loaded onto an HDL particle, and then delivered to the liver for excretion. So, you know, after we finished working on factor VIII for about 3 years, again, it was time to go to the library and find a new project. And that led me to get together with some wonderful collaborators at UC San Francisco who informed me about this process and said that these two enzymes might be rate-limiting in this process of cholesterol removal, and we should clone and express them. They might be good drugs in themselves. These are LCAT and CTEP. CTEP stands for cholesterol ester transfer protein. Has this turned off? Sounds different. Matter of fact, it just fell out. And what it does in this step of the pathway is remove cholesterol from HDL particles, send it toward the liver by transferring it to other lipoproteins, including LDL itself, which I said is the bad cholesterol. So right away, there were some doubts about whether this is actually a good thing to increase CTEP, or maybe it's a bad thing. It helps get rid of cholesterol, but also it puts some of it into particles that can not only go to the liver, but can also go back to your artery wall. So it was a conundrum. And Genentech decided that this wasn't going to be a good drug after all, because treating people with a protein to reduce their risk of heart disease was probably too cumbersome. But surprisingly, to me at least, a number of years later, Pfizer and some other drug companies decided that inhibiting this thing is actually the way to go. I give up. So let me know if you can't hear me in the back. So this became a target, either for making more of or for inhibiting. Is it friend or foe? And I think it's an interesting lesson in the fact that pharmaceutical science, like all of biology, is not an exact science. And when decisions are made, a certain amount of momentum can occur, and it's kind of hard to kill a project or to change your ideas. I'll quickly go through all of this. So if you inhibit that protein, HDL should increase, but you should also be decreasing the flow of cholesterol through that system. So is that good or is that bad? Well, I think that the study that inspired Pfizer to begin this project was a Japanese longevity study. Thank you. And one of the longevity genes, thanks, Mary, that was identified was CTEP itself, which is much more common. CTEP deficiency is much more common in Japan than in the United States. And this strengthened the idea that perhaps people are dying if they have CTEP, and if they don't, they'll live longer. Maybe it's a good target. And actually, the first genetic study suggested that. And then people got started on their inhibitor programs and maybe ignored two subsequent studies which went the other way and actually showed that that CTEP-deficient Japanese subjects did actually not have advanced atherosclerosis, but subsequently studies went the other way around. And unfortunately, transgenic studies, again, went both ways. And if you haven't been involved in following transgenic studies, maybe you aren't aware of the fact that there are nasty little problems such as the strain of mouse that's used or the experimental conditions or the species from which the transgene is taken. And this is not the only case where it went both ways. One group made a transgenic CTEP animal and said that it made atherosclerosis worse, and another group that it made it better. So to go on and on and on, there were rabbit experiments that went both ways, but there was some suggestion that inhibiting it was good, and Pfizer went ahead with it. And they went ahead with it because they're facing the largest patent loss cliff in pharmaceutical history when Lipitor, over a $7 billion drug, goes off patent later this year. So they were heavily motivated to score in the HDL cholesterol arena. And they pushed this into phase three clinical trials. Torcetrapib, the name of that CTEP inhibitor, does increase HDL in human subjects. There was an artery imaging study they did, however, which showed no benefit. But they still pushed ahead because they were already enrolling 30,000 people in their outcomes trial. And unfortunately, this was the outcome. It was a statin, atorvastatin, plus either placebo or torcetrapib. So on placebo, there were 59 deaths. On torcetrapib, 93 deaths. Non-fatal adverse events on placebo, 432. Ontorsetropib, 698. Yikes, this is not a clinical trial that you wanted to be enrolled in. Must have been thousands. They admitted to spending $800 million on this project. It's one of the problems with, maybe it's a panel discussion, but big diseases such as cardiovascular disease and diabetes now take enormous clinical trials. So these studies are not for the faint of heart. They take a lot of money, and the FDA has made it very tough to get such drugs approved now because they require events, outcome studies. They don't just rely on biomarkers anymore because it's come to bite them a few times. And if you're going to enroll a trial for cardiovascular events that happen in maybe 1 to 5% per year, you need a lot of people. So this failed. And did it fail because CETP inhibition is actually bad, which was kind of my pet idea, but I think I was in the minority. Or was there another problem with the drug? It turns out that it was not a clean drug. It had an off-target effect to raise blood pressure, and that may have led to the deaths. So formally, the trial could not distinguish whether the adverse outcomes were due to off-target effects or to CETP inhibition. So the jury is not out. The headlines came out that said, has good cholesterol turned bad? And it certainly affect decisions that were made in pharma companies, but I'll skip through these slides. You know, there could have been a rational way to proceed, which was to do the imaging studies first, see what they told you, and then start enrolling your 30,000 patient outcome study. Two other pharma companies, one of which I think is being represented by someone here in the next couple of days, have decided to push ahead with their own CETP inhibitors, which don't raise blood pressure. So in that sense, they're cleaner drugs. And what I just assumed is that they would do imaging studies first. But it turns out, because of time and patent life and all that, the studies are happening in parallel. So at least in one case, I know that they're doing imaging studies as a subset of the event studies. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. So I'm going to skip this slide and just come back to the basic concept. So here we have, again, this reverse cholesterol transport pathway. And what Pfizer tried to do then is inhibit CETP and make more cholesterol by backing up the system. Well, it didn't seem logical to some of us. And we thought a better thing to do is try to actually drive this system more rapidly by getting more cholesterol out of the cells and onto these HDL particles. And in order to do that, we and others wanted to figure out what this unknown transport protein was. And we decided to take advantage of a rare Mendelian disease, Tangier disease. I think it was alluded to, but not actually said specifically in some of the early talks. Some of these rare orphan diseases are not only things we want to treat, but they can provide great biological insight in ways that can treat many more diseases. So for example, there are only about 40 well-characterized patients in the United States who had this disorder called Tangier disease. Tangier disease patients have no HDL cholesterol. And furthermore, it was known that the defect occurred at the macrophage cell level. That's that cholesterol-filled cell I showed you the EM of earlier. So we figured that we could clone our way into this pathway by finding the defect in Tangier disease. This is what Tangier patients have. Again, they have almost no HDL cholesterol and have an increased risk for heart attacks. When we decided to do this at CV Therapeutics, the problem was for us that other people had already sequestered the very few families that had Tangier disease. And the way that normally you would find a gene that has a disease is look at members of the families and trace down the area of their genome that actually has the gene causing the disease. to say that we couldn't get hold of the families was putting it mildly. This was so ugly and competitive that there were three labs in the world that had control of these families, and there was, you know, one guy said there was a hitman coming from the other lab because he had taken some of the DNAs with him when he left to start his own lab. It wasn't going to work for us. So we decided to take a more simple-minded approach. We were doing gene expression profiling studies on other projects then with our collaborators at Insight, who had one of the early RNA chips. So they had a chip where you could look at the expression of 20,000 genes. And I thought, well, why don't we just do a dumb experiment and take a chance and see if there's a gene that's missing in terms of RNA production if we take RNA from a Tangier patient and compare it to RNA from a normal patient from their cells. So we did have some cells from some Tangier patients, even though we couldn't get near the patients themselves. And on the diagonal are all of the 20,000 genes that had roughly the same amounts of RNA level in the two. If you were down here, you had greater than tenfold less RNA from a certain gene. We picked these 30 or so that were low, and then it only took us a few weeks to directly test them for this gene's ability to remove cholesterol from cells in culture. That's a pretty simple assay, radioactive cholesterol, a no-brainer, and how fast does it get out of the cell? We made antisense RNA to all of those 20, and one of them, when applied to the cell, knocked down cholesterol efflux. Conversely, we had plasmids that expressed all of these. We put them into the Tangier cells, and the plasmid for ABC1, as it was then called, increased cholesterol efflux, and then we sequenced the DNA and indeed found mutations in the ABC gene of people with Tangier disease. And again, by homology to known genes, there was something cool about it that actually, this convinced me it was going to be right before we did the experiments. This is a related gene, so there are about 40 of these sequence-related proteins in the human genome, and this transporter already had a structure, and it sits in the plasma membrane, and it has a big hole in it. And if you look from the side of the membrane, you see this hole. If you look at the top of the plasma membrane, the hole comes out. Well, this is where cholesterol sits in the bilayer. So we thought, this is really cool. Cholesterol goes in there and it gets popped out the hole. It's got to be ABC. So it was. And that part of things went along very swimmingly. And indeed, now that we had a name for this and we had a gene for it, we thought that we're on our way into making an HDL drug that is now more rational, at least I thought, than CETP inhibition, because what you would do is increase the activity of actually getting the cholesterol out of your artery walls. But there's the problem. Mechanistic discoveries don't guarantee drug discovery, and in the 15 years since, no one has come up with a good drug that selectively increases the activity or the gene expression of ABCA1 to turn it into an HDL drug. So how am I doing? So that's the saga of reverse cholesterol transport. And I want to spend the last few minutes by speaking more generally about where we are in drugs to prevent cardiovascular disease. And in keeping score, maybe generously, we're nearly half the way there in creating drugs that correct dyslipidemia, because we've got very good drugs to lower LDL cholesterol. We don't have good drugs to lower other things like triglycerides. We don't have good drugs to raise HDL, but we're covering about half of the people at risk. But that still leaves a few 50 million or so people in the United States, and, you know, obviously the same proportion in the rest of the world, that are not being treated well. And one of the things that I think is important, and a lot of people certainly realize is important, is improved diagnostics. So can we really identify where people lie in the spectrum from having virtually no risk for cardiovascular disease, and you go about your life, or you have moderate risk, and you could therefore moderate your lifestyle more aggressively, If you have slightly higher risk, you can take some of the relatively safe and effective drugs, such as aspirin or statins, not too dangerous, or high risk, in which case you take all of the available drugs and perhaps some invasive procedures. So where do we stand right now? Are current risk factors and biomarkers predictive enough? I think almost everyone's heard the term Framingham risk score. These are pretty good biomarkers of cardiovascular risk. They are gender, age, total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, and smoking status. And more recently, you can add inflammatory markers such as CRP. And indeed, that's quite helpful, except that over half myocardial infarctions, heart attacks, and strokes occur in individuals who would be classified as low to intermediate in their Framingham risk score. And a number of studies have shown that. So what next? What can we do to make diagnostics and predictive medicine for cardiovascular disease better? Well, imaging. This must really predict risk, right? I mean, if you look at an angiograph, you see no blood flow or extreme constriction of blood flow in this coronary artery. Or by non-invasive, high-resolution CT scan, you don't even have to put a dye in the body and you could see a constriction there. Well, that must predict risk, right? Well, not necessarily. Imaging is fine for finding the lesion that you need to put a stent into to prevent the myocardial infarction from happening. But a number of studies have shown that somewhat over one half of the subsequent severe cardiovascular events that occur in people that have already had a lesion stented do not occur in a lesion that looked bad when their initial picture was taken. Well, why is that? It's because this progressive narrowing of the blood vessel by cholesterol doesn't really eventually just narrow to the point where it chokes off the blood supply. What really happens is there's a rupture in the vessel wall and a clot. And that can happen in a lesion that's much smaller than ones that are seen or identified or allowed to be stented at this day and age. And indeed, they look more like something like this. This is what you would call a stable clot, and here's an unstable clot where it is actually burst and caused the thrombus. And that's because on the other side of the hemophilia coin, you know, our body is tuned very well to start clotting right away as soon as it detects a breakage in a blood vessel. So there are things like tissue factor that are buried beneath the surface of a blood vessel, which trigger the clotting cascade just like that once circulating blood sees them. So if you have a little break like that, the clot will happen within seconds. Now this would be great if this were external imaging, but this is not. These are actually pieces of carotid artery that were taken out of someone. So can you actually detect something like this before it happens in a non-invasive way? And you know, that's a holy grail right now. So improved diagnostic predictions and personalized medicine are certainly needed. As I mentioned, imaging and current biomarkers are pretty good, but they're not sufficient. Hypothesis-driven candidate biomarker approach has had some success, i.e. looking at CRP and other inflammatory biomarkers have become more in vogue in the last 5 years or so when it was realized that cardiovascular disease is more than just cholesterol trafficking. There's an inflammatory component as well. But I certainly believe that the promise lies in unbiased omics approaches that Larry introduced to this meeting and I think you're all aware of. So finally, I will wrap up by saying, well, you know, is this disease going away or is it still a big disease or is it increasing? Well, improved treatments are certainly improving survival of myocardial infarctions, but modern lifestyles and advanced age of the population continues to drive up the numbers. And a contributing factor, and I'll finish with this story in a couple of minutes so we can get to lunch and eat more, is the epidemic of diabetes and obesity. And there are lots of ways of saying that diabetes is bad for cardiovascular disease, because it is. in ways that we don't fully understand, having diabetes does bad things to your blood vessels. There were a few hints of that already in presentations today. And probably the most dramatic statement about that was when Ed Bierman gave a talk, and I heard him say, and I've seen this number now, that 2/3 of diabetics will die of heart disease before they reach age 60. So it's a driver of cardiovascular disease, and probably many of you have seen things like this diagram. This is the advance of obesity in this country, state by state. In 1994, the biggest color was 14% or so of the state's population was obese. That only happened in Indiana and a few others. Delaware's in there. By 2000, you now had to add a category of up to 25% of people in the states were obese. And by 2007, you had to add the category of over 26% of the people were obese in each state. And unfortunately, it's not just cosmetic, because obesity predisposes to the development of diabetes. So if you look at the numbers for diabetes, they followed the same trend. Again, in 94, you had maybe two states that creeped above 6%. Now, over 9% diabetics in the state by 2007. Of course, it's silly to think that things are going to be linear forever, but I did see a paper when I was researching this that said, if this trend continues at the same rate, half of the children born in 2000 will become diabetic. Anyway, it's a lot of people. And they're going to have heart disease. So this disease is not going to go away, and I think it has to be treated in a number of ways. I'll let that stay for a little bit. And one of them clearly is to try to reverse the lifestyle changes that have brought about this epidemic of diabetes and heart disease. But it's not so easy to do. We evolved probably as a species that found meals occasionally, ate all of the animal that was dead, and didn't get another good meal for a couple of days. Clearly, we're much more physically active, and probably evolution didn't care about us living to be more than 20 or 30 years old. So we can't really reverse all of that for everyone. So I think what we need is not only modification in lifestyle and diagnostics that will tell people how hard they should work to avoid this disease, but also development of pharmaceutical products as well. So at least for the epidemic of cardiovascular disease, I'll finish with this slide and say that a little bit of red wine, I didn't talk about that, but they're actually, the American Heart Association is very careful about how they say this, but there's a J-shaped curve of cardiovascular disease risk, of diabetes risk, of HDL cholesterol levels, yada, yada, where you're better off with one or two glasses of wine a day than with none. But then again, you get far worse with four or five glasses of wine a day. So it's a J-shaped curve. So moderate drinking, exercise, and pills, I think, are the ways to try to reduce the scourge of cardiovascular disease in the future. And with that, let's have lunch. Thanks.
I think Colonel Sanders and his colleagues are still setting up the buffet, so we can take a couple quick questions. Let's get someone.
If we were to eat the whole animal, we'd probably get a lot of saturated fat, and yet we're told not to eat saturated fat. Could you comment on that?
Not really. I mean, it's some studies say it's really only it's calories that count. Clearly, some lipids are better for you, and some are worse for you. But the dietary, I'm not a dietitian, so I don't want to dip into that too much, but it's a tough concept when you're doing human trials based on what people eat or don't eat in studies in which are not necessarily controlled for everything else they do in their lives. So unfortunately, the public gets confused by recommendations that change after a few years. So I think it makes, you know, it makes it tough for people to follow some of those studies. Clearly, there are some kinds of lipids that are more dangerous than others. Hi, Gary.
You started your talk with some of these studies that went both ways, and you mentioned one of the confounding factors was different strains of mice. Is this working? I can't tell. Different
mice.
Strains of animals, mice.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, that's one of the explanations for why that could happen. So it wasn't too many years ago that there was a lot of press about the new field of pharmacogenomics, where you would hopefully be able to tell which drug is appropriate for which person based on their overall genetics of that individual person. I haven't heard so much about it lately. Could you comment on, is that really going to be the savior of pharmaceutical
industry? So the question is, what's happened to the promise of pharmacogenomics? There have been some triumphs. I think Larry gave you the other side of it. It's not going to, totally revolutionize medicine. But there are some triumphs. So, for example, one of the most used clotting agents, anti-clotting agents, clopidogrel, which is rat poison, warfarin, which is used a lot. And if you think about it, if you're taking something that's going to control bleeding or clotting, too much of it is bad, right? You need just the right amount. And it was known for a number of years that there's a varied response to clopidogrel treatment in terms of how effective it stops your bleeding. And alleles for two genes, one that's involved in maturing the drug, the prodrug, and another in its detoxification by the liver, that there are alleles in them that predict clopidogrel response and logically would therefore inform dosing of clopidogrel. Well, it's had some impact, but it hasn't really caught on because a lot of docs are going to say still, we'll give a small dose and do bleeding time and then titrate the dose up. So there have been some successes, but probably not as many as was originally touted. That's it.
Yeah, relating your talk to the talk of the previous speaker, I remember being a layperson. I remember vaguely, I think it was a mouse as opposed to a rat study, epigenetic, looking at obesity. And so the question I have for you is, to what extent are we looking now at the developmental origins of some of these illnesses? Because, of course, the magnitude of the change is quite profound. And of course, we've had, if we go back the last 20 or 30 years, the nature of the food that we're beginning to take in, the nature of our diet, the quality of the diet, the presence of fructose and other things, to what extent are we beginning to look at the developmental issues related to the expression of these diseases later on?
Okay, I could go a number of ways in commenting on that question. Perhaps this isn't the one you intended, but it feeds into Gary's question and comment about transgenic mouse models. The mouse models actually weight things perhaps too much on the developmental side. You're knocking out or adding a gene before birth, so the animal has that throughout lifetime. And in some cases, those lessons don't translate into drug discovery because you're taking something that a person had for the first 40 years of their life and then trying to knock it down with a drug as opposed to a knockout mouse that had that in utero. So development is important, and that's maybe the flip side of it, is it's too much overemphasized in some of the mouse models. And perhaps to kind of end, you also hinted at, I think, one of the issues, which is, trying to prove the efficacy of these drugs is really a rough game for we can give pharmaceutical companies a lot of grief, and there's no shortage of grief given to pharmaceutical companies in this country. But one of the difficulties is that if you take these huge diseases of metabolic diseases, huge in terms of numbers, such as obesity and diabetes, and look at what's happened in the FDA in the last 10 years, almost no drugs have been approved. And the ones that have been knocked down this year, three obesity drugs were knocked down in the FDA. A couple of diabetes drugs were knocked down in the last few years. I'll bet it costs $500 million at least to take any one of those to the failure phase. The one I showed you, Pfizer admits openly to having spent $800 million on what led to the failure of torsetrapib. And that's, again, because the FDA, rightly or wrongly, it's a matter of debate. You know, the FDA has two things it's supposed to do. It's supposed to provide novel drugs to save lives or make lives better, and it's supposed to keep unsafe drugs off the market. And for better or worse, the pendulum has swung toward the right. For now, safety barriers are extremely high, for not for cancer or not for diseases that are going to kill the patient within 6 months, but for other metabolic diseases or things like arthritis that you can't say are going to kill someone right away if they don't have a drug. So these studies are not for the faint of heart. And you know, fewer and fewer companies, Larry mentioned infectious diseases, but fewer and fewer companies are rolling the dice on new obesity and diabetes drugs for the same reason. So it's tough. It's not that people have given up, but at least in the biotech world, one last comment. At the BIO meeting, BIO is this organization of biotechnology companies, and they met with the FDA recently, and one of the people on the BIO board actually challenged the new head of the FDA by saying that until you make it possible for a company to return its investment on developing a new diabetes drug, we're not going to invest in new diabetes drugs. So it's tough, because on the other hand, you don't want flimflammery, you don't want thalidomides out there, even though that is a drug now. It's a tough balance. I think we should stop.
Right? So we'll start again right at 1:15. I think we should thank Dick and all the speakers for their time.